If your restaurant wants to put the best on the table, look for food with the New York State Certified Seal. It's food that is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to episode 7 of Why Food. I'm your host, Patrick McAndrew. Why Food is all about people, their connection to food, and the story of why they left their previous life or career path to now find themselves immersed in the food industry. I'm honored to sit here and meet such compelling people who are examples of how broad the food industry is in the 21st century. And today's guest exemplifies the show's tagline, One Industry Fits All. Shentong was one of the student leaders in the democracy movement at the Tiananmen Square in 1989. Years later, he was also an active participant in the Occupy Wall Street movement. He's also a software inventor, entrepreneur, serial investor, social activist, but most recently, Shen is the founder of two impactful food accelerators, Food Future Inc. and FoodX. Shen, thank you very much for joining me on Why Food.
Happy to be here. We actually just rebranded called Food Future Co. Community. Yeah.
Now I have to say, well, first of all, I suppose I should tell you this because I haven't told you this, but when I moved to New York a year and a half ago, and I moved here, I had done corporate law and I wanted to get into food. I had worked with startup companies for 7 months in an enterprise center in Ireland. Uh-huh. And I had a great interest in food because I spent a year abroad in Toulouse. That's where I got my connection to food. So I came out here and I wanted to do something impactful because that's kind of what I grew up with, that food was very important. If you use food to heal yourself, food was the basis of humanity. You kind of started at food and worked your way up. So I came out here to try and get into it with no real experience in it and no general idea of what I wanted to do.
We won't hold that against you.
Yeah. That's
good, we'll be actually back in Toulouse in a week.
Really?
We're going on a trip with my son to Italy in Bologna area in a 1,000-year farm. Actually, it's a partner we're developing for farm education, kind of like Stone Barn, but 1,000-year old in northern Italy. And then a road trip up to Dijon, where I'm going to speak at the National Convention for Food in France.
Okay. Yeah, Toulouse is brimming with food. It's not really a tourist place, I don't think, but to live there's so much going on in terms of food and drink. And the reason why I got access to it was I was running a gastropub with my friend, and it was owned by a couple. So it was a small operation, and it was the two of us that would run it. I was never particularly good behind the bar, so I would spend my time up in the kitchen with the wife when it got very busy, and that's where I kind of got into it. But to bring me back to New York, when I came to New York, I wanted to find somewhere that felt like it would fit my ethos, that the what I wanted to do and what I wanted to achieve. And there was only three places that I could find. There was a company called Ace Naturals, based out in Queens, that sourced organic produce to organic restaurants in the city. There was Dig In, who I suppose were really exploding and expanding. Adam Eskin's going to be on the show next year. We were hoping to have him on last week, but because he's expanding so rapidly, he wasn't able to find time to get on. And then there was your company. It was Food Future. It was FoodX, actually, the one that I was looking at the most. But I had such a limited experience in... I saw it as being a venture capitalist firm that I thought it wasn't something that I could really get myself into. But now that I got the show, I thought instantly, Shen is a guy that I have to have on, because you really resemble the transition of moving from... Well, you have a whole elective of careers into food.
Yeah, well, the venture capital part is only a small part of it. Money is very important. In fact, if you look through all the companies that go through accelerators, I would say high 90% hell go through accelerators in the hope that they will get not just funding, but strategic funding, right? But being an accelerator in general, which really brings in the networking. But now, especially with Food Future Co., where we have a delivery quite different from other accelerators, where we have executive consulting. We really have a long program and senior staff working with each company, not in a one-size-fits-all in terms of get the pitch deck ready, get your business plan investment ready, and then based on understand some basics about growth curves, but also specifically what each company's challenges within the context of various inflection points of food sustainable agriculture's shift to good food. You know, so we also focus on a particular stage, which we call a scale-up stage. So, for example, our companies have minimum $1 million revenue. So that means, especially in category creators, they're usually leader in their own category. So they're an established company, but still small. Small not just in terms of revenue, but small in terms of compared to their potential to have mainstream impact in whichever areas, innovation areas they're working on. So that is using a business school jargon, that's a big chasm, that's a big scary chasm to cross from the acquired customer and thought leadership in early adopters to mainstream.
And what's your role within the two companies at the moment, between FoodX and Food Future? What's your role between the two companies?
I founded FoodX 2.5 years ago, and I run three cohorts till end of 2015, when I founded Food Future Co. And so I'm not running, I'm just a founder. I'm not running FoodX day-to-day, but I'm pretty much exclusively focused on Food Future as an accelerator, but also the now 30 plus companies that gone through my acceleration programs, so we have many years to follow on to help these companies and find additional investment when they need to, and then keep evolving the network, which is actually possibly the most valuable part of what we offer, what we help to the companies. And the networks means advisors, mentors, strategically aligned investors, and last but certainly not least, the alumni network and other founders, which is proved invaluable to the individual companies.
Yeah, it's pretty inspiring what you're doing, but what's most captivating, and definitely it was for me when I was trying to get to know more about you coming into the show, is all the other guests that I've had, they've kind of come from a split. You know, they've come from one career path into another. Whereas with you, it's not. It's almost like a Shakespearean tale. There's tons and tons of stories.
Don't hold that against me.
There's so many stories that are running in tandem with each other, and they cross paths every now and again. But it's when I tried to give a description as to who you were, I couldn't say Shen was a social activist, or Shen was a software investor or developer, and now is in food, because it's not the truth. You're still constantly doing all that stuff. So how do you manage it with everything that you're doing at the moment?
Well, Patrick, first of all, it's a singularity to me. I mean, it's just one single thing. I find I'll take two career paths to describe it. So I was trained a philosopher. I was a PhD program at Harvard for many years, and I also was involved. You mentioned Tiananmen, Occupy Wall Street, and there's many movement in between. I was seriously involved with, and now clearly a joint food movement a little less than 3 years ago. So all of this, I find myself really excited and passionate about big and useless ideas.
Not useless.
So I think about really broad questions, and especially food. It kind of all my previous experiences and trial and errors, most of failures have come together, because for the last decade, way before I throw myself 100% into the food movement, I just everywhere I look, it just seems very clear that food agriculture is not just related to, but central to almost all the major challenges we're facing for the coming decades. So it's not, of course, food and beverage itself as the most important commodity. It's important. Right? I mean, it's a big market. It's and if you include agriculture, it's a $9 trillion market currently in the world, right? And over 90% of that is wrong, not sustainable. So it's just gigantic opportunity and gigantic impact, right? But beyond that, you'll have health, especially personal wellness part of health, right? And then you'll have green tech, clean tech. I mean, that part of environmental aspects, right? Those four things are straightforward. Again, food and beverages, agriculture, health, and environment. But think about education, think about war, energy, transportation, poverty, gender issues. Food is just central. Food, agriculture are central to all those questions, right? I think with probably the exception of space travel and self-driving cars, and this food will be just central to almost all the, basically all the challenges we have. So in a way that, I mean, Mark Bittman once, out of frustration, said, you have to fix everything to fix food. Right. And I think for those of us who have been in the food space, whether as a thinker or a watcher or especially a doer, we all had their fair share of that frustration, right? But for me, when I find this formula, when I kind of discovered or follow the right my inspirations and the people who have been on this path early, that I see it the exactly opposite way. I say, when we fix food, we fix everything, yeah.
But what was it that led you to it? Because was it working on all these different paths in life that you saw the correlation between food and the connection with food? Or had you grown up where food was, it was inbred in you that it was a very important and crucial factor of a life? I watched your TED Talk and you said that you've been aware of food for a long time, and you spoke of raising your son and how important it was that you sit down for dinner together. Was that always ingrained in you, that food had
it? Well, with hindsight, a story is always more coherent, right? But coming into it, it wasn't, I was aware of food because, grew up in China in the late 60s, early 70s, there's just this scarcity of food, even in the capital of a police state like China. I grew up in Beijing, right? It's just not enough. I mean, it's all rotion, I mean, we only eat cabbage and a little bit pork during winter. Right, but being a foodie and just loving food, it's just something I cook since I was very at a young age, all the way through graduate school, and I still have a professional kitchen in my Soho home, and now it's a little bit fancier at the time, so having chef friends coming over and big parties and
you got to impress,
yeah, but I just love it. I just don't have enough. I wish I had more time to cook. It's just something that remains to be a second nature for me, cooking and touching food and playing with food and sharing that meal with family. But the daily reminder that really got me into food in such a concentrated way are my children. I have three young children, and being a parent in America is hard. Because we now know the numbers. I mean, there's only around 10% of produce that are good food in the marketplace right now, and less than 0.5% of animal protein that are clean and good tasting and also have other impact, which is sustainable animal protein. So it's really, really difficult that whether it's a school lunch or going out on a trip or going out to eat, you know, more than 90% of food would not nurture their body. You will feel their stomach, and so it will kill the sensation of hunger at the moment, right? But it's high in calorie with negligible nutrients. So in other words, generally, they're going to just get fatter and wider and bigger, but well, not nourished. So when I try to pay a little bit attention and say, well, how do we source food right? Then it's kind of worms. It's just all these issues come. It's really difficult to actually source food that is actually nutritious and not poisonous.
Yeah, the thing that I found most interesting, really, because you raise all the issues that are central to making sure that food is more accessible and it's more democratized and definitely an enterprise so that it is more accessible for companies to come in and establish themselves in the market. But you're talking about a food movement. You're leading the food movement with your companies. When I was in Ireland, I brought the show to Ireland with me, and I met two twins called they're Stephen and David Flynn, and they have a company called The Happy Pair. Mm-hmm. Now, they're similarly leading a food movement in Ireland. It started off with the fruit and veg shop, and it grew and grew and grew. Now it's far more expansive, and people are coming to them and visiting their place to have their plant-based food, to try it. And although there's so many things that changing the food system will affect, but I think everybody has to focus on, not everybody has to, but everyone takes an angle as to what they're going to focus on, the impact that they want to make the most. Now, your history is obviously in social activism, so there's a very political charge to what you're trying to do with the food. Like I've heard you say, each purchase is a vote. What do you mean by that? That each purchase is a vote? Each purchase is reflective of how you see the food industry, or how do you feel?
Well,
about
there's
that?
A, there's a, there's the power of purchasing. So we can when we share food, when we buy produce, when we buy protein, and where we eat, where we spend our dollars, there is a very immediate and direct impact each one of us can make. This is actually quite different from representative democracy, where you vote in cycles and you don't have to. A lot of people don't vote, unfortunately, right? But we have to eat every day, and we can make a difference. And it's there's a direct connectedness there. But I don't see my involvement in the food movement and what I hope for my contribution to food movement much as a political movement. Food is inherently political, but I see a particular opportunity and shared by my partners and now, you know, all these dozens of companies that it is a, we're building a business engine for the food movement. Because, policy is incredibly important in change of food or keeping the status quo, which is not sustainable and it's bad for culture, bad for our health, right? But policy is incredibly important. Cultural advocacy education is incredibly important. Direct political or social movement is important. Think of potato workers protest or for fast food workers' demands for higher minimum wage, right? All of those are important, but there's a unique aspect of which, one, that was lacking a few years ago, and two, is more unique and inherent to the food space as a commodity business. That is, we can leverage entrepreneurship and innovation. And instead of, or in addition to fighting the current bad practices and systems head on, we could just make it obsolete. You know, we can build better practice and better offering. So the way is not so much to educate and advocate and protest. It's more to build something people want, and within that you can sneak in what we believe is what people need. It's a consumer market mechanism that we can leverage, but with awareness of where we're going, the general trajectory of a tastier, healthier, sustainable, and affordable, accessible food.
Are you of the belief that to make a stronger impact, it has to start from a grassroots level where you have people on the ground who are making the decisions for themselves, as opposed to pushing and lobbying the government to make the policy changes that some people hope will trickle down to affect the people on the ground?
You know, not so much as supposed to, but I've done a few things and failed at many, and I realized that the best I can do is to really try 100% to be good at one thing, not terrible on 12, right? So again, I see there's four main engines for the change of food: policy, direct democracy or social movement, cultural and educational push, and the business engine. So we're really focusing on the whole community of Food Future Co. is focusing on building that business engine, but also sharing, if not leading by example. So we can only do so much. It's that we have to inspire others and also join forces with other aspects, like, you know, in the cultural aspects. All my food heroes have trailblazed, and we're really standing on the shoulder of other giants, people like Dan Barber, people like Michael Pollan, like Mark Bittman, and the farmers, the nameless farmer, who are not famous yet, but they preserved certain practices that need to be restored. So that our general thesis has been that we want to build innovations through entrepreneur spirit, so that the smarter systems out there, the two most important ones, resilience of nature, that's nature-centric farming, and the resilience of culture, which is more culinary tradition, can be leveraged so that technology and science and capital levers are help and amplifier of those resilient systems. they should be in that. They're very important, but they should be in the right place, because we have lost our way in the last half century, where we put those things in the center. And then we forgot the smarter systems can do so much more than human play God, than science and technology by itself. It's incredibly important to have modern conveniences in science and technology, but they should be used to leverage the resilience of nature and culture.
I'm really intrigued about the holistic approach that you've taken to your investment firms, and we're going to go to a quick break. But once we get back, I just want to talk about the approach that you've developed in those companies.
New York chefs and restaurants are proud of the food they put on the table. And serving produce that comes from local, environmentally responsible farms is a way to leave an even better taste in everyone's mouth. So when shopping for your ingredients, look for the New York State Grown and Certified seal. It lets you know which food is grown right here in New York State, certifying the food that comes from local farms that meet a higher standard. You'll not only be serving local food, you'll be supporting local farmers. Learn more about the New York State Grown and Certified program at certified.ny.gov.
Welcome back to Why Food. I'm here with Shen Tong, the founder of Food Future Co. and FoodX. So, just before the break, we were talking about your past and what's brought you to here. And now I want to talk about the holistic approach, as I was saying. And one thing that I was, because I've been thinking about this show now for the past week, and I've been kind of looking at all the major food investment companies around, or the companies that have been invested in, such as Dig In, like Adam Meskin that we've spoken about. A company that I thought about was Sweetgreen, because they've been getting a lot of investment. And
yeah. They're a little too later stage for us. Otherwise, I would have loved to invest in them. Yeah,
I'm sure. But they were, I don't know if it was a TED talk, if it was another talk, but I heard you discussing about, you know, investing in something authentic and true, as opposed to investing in something that's a chip off another model, which is very brave for an investment company, because investment companies, I'm sure, are so bound to following trends. So I was in a bar 2 days ago and I met three guys from Denmark who worked at Joe and the Juice. And Joe and the Juice is a place in Soho, for anyone who doesn't know, and it's a juice bar that was developed in Copenhagen and now finds itself in Asia, in Europe, and it's come to the States. And it just got invested in by General Atlantic, who also have their hand in Uber. And they told me that they're looking to put 80 Joe and the Juice in Manhattan to expand it that rapidly. But when I read an article about it, what I found so interesting was this was the comment by the guy who had just invested in it. It has a broad menu mix that follows key trends in healthy living and convenience, which we think will resonate extremely well with the U.S. That kind of struck me, because what they were focusing on there was the fact that it was going to resonate with people, as opposed to what you're doing, which is starting something that people may be totally unaware of, or people mightn't even realize that will impact their lives. And that's the major difference between what you're doing and someone like General Atlantic is doing and investing in a healthy company. So you may have someone like Sweetgreen, which isn't necessarily there for the average person because it's too expensive or it's not in their area, whereas what you're doing appears to be far more impactful, and I think that is led by the holistic approach.
Well, thank you for that perspective. I mean, I appreciate that, the confidence and certainty. I'm not quite there yet, because we learn from failure. So we follow Lean and design thinking methodology. So it's more about having a general trajectory and start doing and learn from mistakes and adjust. You know, aim, fire, and adjust. But also the holistic framing that how you from outside looking at what we're doing, that it is true, it's holistic in several ways. One is that tying to the earlier question about political movement versus what we're building, this is business engine for change of food, that this is not a confrontational movement. I mean, not from our perspective. I mean, the social protest and to some extent maybe policy or even cultural advocacy could be confrontational. But movement in general need to expect opposition. Trend doesn't. Trend is much more passive, much more transient, and you don't have to expand opposition to a trend. But as a movement, by the very nature, we should expect opposition. But again, our approach to opposition is not a heads-on. You know, it's more making the bad practices obsolete. But also, in terms of investment, I mean, there are just different ways of approaching it. Following trend is one way, and that's also usually more appropriate to later stage investment. But for early stage investment, in fact, I think more impactful venture capital, we generally follow this idea of contrarian but logical. So it makes sense, the logic of having good agriculture, good food, that is not just good in itself, but also have compounded impact in environment and health, is quite established, is well understood. But it's contrarian because scalable businesses currently rely heavily on seed labs, global logistics, large-scale industrial farming, and large-scale food production, focusing on long shelf lives, focusing on only single factor output, which is calorie, right? So that seems to be the scale. So what's contrarian is that, well, that's one, that's not sustainable. Two, in order to break that mold, the answer is not within that mold. The answer is outside that. We're in Brooklyn, right? That this food is new black. This is the center of the food universe, right?
I think that's your favorite quote, isn't it? Food is the new black.
Yeah, it's still the new black. I wish I can. I hope I can keep saying this for the next 10 years. So that means it's a highly fragmented, but very very authentic ground up movement where people really just, especially for Americans, different from Europeans and Asians, we both have that background, where there's still this amazing wide-eyed fascination about, wow, fermentation, locally produced meat, humanely raised hogs and farms nearby that just taste not only 10 times better, it's just 100 times more vibrant, different.
Do you find inspiration when you go to Asia and when you go to Europe to see how the food market, you know, obviously it still has its major issues, but it's not as crippled as the U.S. is. Do you find inspiration or does it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah? Absolutely. When I mentioned that, you know, our core thesis, in one way you can describe it, nature, culture, and modern conveniences. The third one we talk about a lot, money and technology and science, very important, the modern business models, right? But the culture, we're really referring to culinary traditions. So this trip to Southern Europe is coming up this afternoon, and Buddhist tradition in terms of a protein alternative. I mean, those are just two examples where culinary tradition are stayed somewhat true to its roots, but also relevant to modern time. That's definitely a broad source and deep source of inspiration for our approach. Basically, we're looking for that authenticity, not only in founder stories and funding stories, which is common as accelerator, but we're looking for authenticity in terms of connection to the culinary tradition, the chef's approach, and so to food. So for us, when we look at our mission filters, the first and foremost mission filter out of the six is taste. After that, it's sustainability, accessibility, affordability, health, and then personal communal responsibilities. So it's all about taste. It's food. So it's respect our taste bud and it respect our body. We're putting things in people's body. We lost our way when we just look at output and calorie because we're not just a vessel for volume. We have such a robust second brain and primary brain and taste bud. And then we are, like it or not, part of nature. This body is a natural composition, right? So the way we primarily relate to nature is through food, and culinary tradition have sorted that out over thousands of years in many different cultures.
You've spoken before of seeing the light. You see the finish. You see the end line of where it's going to end up. Now, before I ask you how it's going to get there or what the vision is, what's the greenest light that you've gotten? What's the closest thing that you have in touching distance of making a big change? Because I'm sure there's things such as policy and changing the way that big agri companies operate and the finance that they get from the government. What are the things that are closest to our grasp to change and make the biggest impact quick?
Well, this movement, different from most others have joined, is that the consumer, the general public, have achieved such a degree of awareness that we just need to offer what they want. There's not that much education needed. Education needs to be continuous, right? But in general, people are looking for better food, better alternatives. People are really investing time and emotion into touching right food, you know, breaking it down, call it Generation Yum, turn it to a millennial or a Gen Z. Deep city psychological and trendy need of saying, well, we can't break down anything else, whether it's politics or iPhone, right? But this is one thing that matters so much that it's been so bad, but I can touch, I can do something, I can improvise, and I can do wonders, in my kitchen, even if just taking out of a DIY box, right? So it's just really interesting. Americans do a lot of things backwards, right? So I want to cook, instead of going to a market, I just get a box and then do it for 7 minutes or 40 minutes, right? So I mean, all of that is, so that's there, right? People are reading labels, they don't really get the right information, they don't really get the clear answer from label, but they don't stop, they keep reading those labels. So we actually need to move fast. We need to accelerate to really try to fill that void. And you can look at all the market numbers. I mean, why organic stays this high price? It's not because currently organic is not scaled enough to bring the price down, because eventually organic will be cheaper than the conventional. Well, it's strange to call it conventional, the industrial agriculture and food production. Organic should be cheaper than that. But right now, it's a very simple market mechanism. The demand surpasses supplies. That's why organic stays high. So it's not like, oh, it's too expensive, therefore there's no future. Well, it's too expensive, and there definitely is a future because there's more people want it than the supply. So it's a consumer demand-driven, supply-constrained opportunity. So that's why focusing on the supply, focusing on making options, focusing on much even more highly fragmented market is a way to really make this major shift.
Is there a fear, though, that with all the efforts in America now to transition it and turn it back to bring it to its roots and strip away all the big agri, that these guys are moving abroad and they're conquering countries in Asia and bringing their Western methods to them, that the next step will actually be following a pursuit of trying to go to the different continents and the different countries and reverse what's happening against their traditions? Do you see an issue happening?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Patrick, it's good you brought out that perspective. There's we know there's a serious issue with hunger, 850 million people. There's a serious issue with water, about a billion people that doesn't have enough food or clean water today. But there's one thing that's even broader, one problem even broader than water and hunger problem. That is this peculiar version of Western diet. It's not really Western. This is fast food and packaged food, basically highly processed food, which is majority of the food out there, right? So those, unfortunately, were often championed by big American companies, European, Asian also, but this is the large scale trend currently. And then we're building a counter trend. Currently, the large scale trend is that any country barely getting out of poverty, first thing they do, the farmers and the poor people, they go to McDonald's and they buy soda, they buy Coca Cola and Pepsi, and it's a matter of trendiness and pride, right? So that's one trend. The counter trend is that we're here to undo that, to make fast and casual restaurant or home food or bottled drinks good again, right? So in other parts of the world, those two trends are happening. It's very interesting, for example, following the Obama's visit to Cuba, there's such an interest trend into Central America where food is happening two ways. Organic export from those areas because the grounds and soils are not depleted, right? But meanwhile, the highly processed food import into the area. So both trends are happening over there.
It's brutal to see it happening like that. Just going back to when I lived in France, and I went to France and my mind was blown when I would go to the markets and I would get to stand beside French people cooking and start to understand their passion for food and wine. But at the same time, between the hours of 2:30 and between the hours of 2:30 and 5, you couldn't get food anywhere in Toulouse because it was so rooted in its traditions that all the restaurants would close for those hours, so you couldn't get any food. So McDonald's, I think at that time when I was living in France, we looked it up. France was the biggest booming country for McDonald's in the world. And you could see that when we were going, watch Champions League games on the weekdays. There was TVs everywhere that would sell Heineken. So everybody, instead of going to bars, would go to McDonald's. You'd get your fries, you'd get your burgers, and you'd sit there all night and watch the games. Then you'd go there the next day when you were hungover. And it was just the trend that was followed.
But in a way, we can even look at that and see hope, not more than hope, sustaining trend and the real movement forward, which is that if we look at the last 50 years as food movement, just getting into large scale and volume, calories output, right? The next 50 years is get food good again. You know, so modern cuisine itself is not the problem. It's losing our way of putting science and technology and modern communities and franchise chains and global logistics central kitchen in the center, forgetting culinary tradition, which is, again, not just cultural tradition. It's very smart system on how to make the best out of what nature produce, right? So then it's nature, culinary tradition. So look at our companies. I mean, they're now reviewing, after reviewing now nearly 3,000 companies, and really work very closely with really highly innovative superstar entrepreneurs. I think I have 33 companies in the portfolio, the agriculture and food portfolio. So there's it's not the hard work. Which is exciting by itself, but it's really what their tractions have shown, that they're capturing the cultural shift and behavioral shift among the consumers, among the general public, but shifting that. So the interest in packaged food and in fast food chains, even that can be shifted. And people are doing that. That's why the new chains are. I mean, even Chipotle, which is an earlier example, right? It's doing. You compare Chipotle and McDonald's, you can see the shift, right? So again, it's general public driven, but supply constrained. In other words, that if we build it, people will definitely come. They line up without even knowing where and when it's going to be built.
And with your focus on, you know, the all-encompassing aspects of food and the impact that it has on the environment and culture and everybody else, is there a pigeonhole that you try to avoid of saying, you know, not vegetarian, not necessarily paleo or any of those things? What's your approach to those diets? Do you just treat it as going back to nature, or do you advocate for a vegetarian diet or
the,
for vegan?
The pigeonhole, categorically, we try to avoid trend. Actually, you know, and in terms of where we start, right? That's one aspect, right? Because we want to be contrarian, we want to be ahead of the curve. I mean, it's a tall order, but that's the intent. That there's a methodology to that, right? The other thing is that we generally stay above cell level, so we want to be as whole food as possible. Right, so the GMO is here to stay, and the pure food tech in many different ways, and using jingang is just one of them. Highly processing of food probably will have a place continuously in the food and agricultural world, whether we like it or not. I don't have a particular ideological idea and opinion about it, but our approach, again, trying to be good at one thing, not terrible on 12, is to really look at how the best way, not doing away with modern conveniences, refrigeration, transportation, packaging, keeping it fresh, keeping it safe, right? But to use all of that to try to preserve as much as possible the wholesomeness of what nature and the culinary tradition produce. So I mean, those would be the two major categories we try to avoid. Yeah.
Is the food industry, has it got a prosperous outlook in the eyes of Shentong?
Has
it got a prosperous outlook? Do you see a bright future from your eyes with what you see, with who you're involved in?
Oh, absolutely. Better. You know, I got three young kids. I got to pay their bills.
Yeah.
No, but I do. I mean, this is, you know, at Tayo Patrick, it's not just... all these theories, and but more importantly, it's on a daily basis, working with these entrepreneurs and seeing their traction. I mean, just like I feel the same excitement in terms of a day-to-day interaction with the market, with a potential customer, with partners, just like 20 years ago when I started my first software company. It's that kind of a velocity, that kind of acceleration. But more than anything else, it's really that food people are just happy people, you know. And when things are really happening, and there's a really bright future, and there's a huge job to do, because again, over 90% of food that can and should be changed for better food, right? And it's just different. Partially is inherent in the fact that we're building solutions people want, not confronting, not taking that approach. As important as that approach is in the food movement, we're not doing that. But also part of it is just inherent in food agriculture. Food brings people together and makes people happy. So this is not a confrontational movement. This is kind of a delicious and happy movement.
A delicious and happy movement. Gen, can you, or Shen, pardon me, can you please tell me what the food industry has given you since you've joined it, I suppose, since you've officially joined it with the companies?
It gives me a lifelong hope and wish, and turning that into a reality, which is I always wondered my what I have to do to work to build businesses, and then what I love to do, which is making impact and living a life that is a little bit larger than yourself, and so through what I'm doing now, I can see and I live it every day that you can do well by doing good.
You're an inspiring
thanks
man.
Thanks to the food movement.
Thanks very much for joining me on My Food Show.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. You've achieved so much, and I really can't wait to see what both of the accelerators are going to do in the future. I'll definitely
fingers
be keeping
crossed.
Up with it. Yeah, fingers crossed for everyone.
Thank
I
you,
think.
Patrick.
And thank you to the wonderful people at Heritage Radio Network for giving me the opportunity to make this show. It's an incredible platform to communicate and engage with people in the food industry. If you want to listen to more shows or learn more about the network, please visit heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you to the great David Tadashore for producing today's show. I got his name right. Yes. Thank you. He's got a tricky last name. And thank you so much to you for listening to the show. If you want to get in touch, you can do so by emailing whyfood@heritageradionetwork.org. And if you did enjoy the show, please rate and review the show on iTunes or Stitcher. It makes a massive difference. Next week, I'll be talking to Ali Shaper from Brooklyn Oenology. She was previously an engineer and left her position 10 years ago to change the world of wine here in the East Coast. So, should be another very interesting show. Thank you very much, guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.